This year, during the school year, we've been wandering with the children of Israel in the wilderness. We don't want to do it for 40 years. Some might have even questioned us doing it for a whole year. But our reason for studying this subject is a very practical one. We are repeating the history of that people. And when we discover why they wandered and why they finally entered the promised land, we understand some things about our dilemma and why we're still here. We're getting down toward the close of this study, and it gets exciting because they are very near to the borders of the earthly Canaan now. Very near, but many of them still far away in heart. The reason they wandered for 40 years is because of unbelief, lack of faith, pure and simple. And the reason they finally entered the promised land, according to the book of Deuteronomy, was not because they had, as a body, total group, changed that much. It was because the nations of the heathen had filled up their cup of iniquity. And God shook out the people who were not ready to go in and took the ones who could across the Jordan. The reason we finally enter the heavenly country in these days is not because we, as a body of 2 or 3 million people or whatever, have changed that much. It is because the nations of this world have filled up their cup of iniquity, and God takes those into the heavenly country who are ready to go in. He shakes out the rest. So if you've been waiting around for 2 or 3 million people to reproduce the character of God, don't hold your breath. That's one of the lessons from this study. I believe that Jesus is coming very soon, whether 3 million people are ready or not. And it's based on this study. The last time we studied this group of people, they had come up to Kadesh Barnea a second time with the opportunity to enter the promised land. A second time they had turned down God's invitation. And they entered on a 2-year detour around the land of Edom. It was during this 2-year detour that the snakes came into camp. Many people died. Some lived because they looked at the cross in the wilderness. And finally, we see them in Numbers, the 22nd chapter today, right on the borders of the promised land once more. In fact, they are right on the Jordan River. Numbers, the 22nd chapter, starting with verse 1. And the children of Israel set forward and pitched in the plains of Moab on this side Jordan by Jericho. And Balak, the son of Zippor, saw all that Israel had done to the Amorites. Now Balak got nervous because the Amorites had already conquered the Moabites. Balak was king of the Moabites, and he figured by putting two and two together that if the Israelites conquered the Amorites, who had already conquered them, that they were in deep trouble. He figured there was no point in trying to fight, and so he came up with a bright idea. He'd use psychological warfare. He'd use hocus pocus and mumbo jumbo type things. Verse 4. And Moab said unto the elders of Midian, Now shall this company look up all that are round about us. And Balak, the son of Zippor, was king of the Moabites at that time. Verse 5, he sent messengers therefore unto Balaam, the son of Beor, saying, Behold, there is a people come out from Egypt. Behold, they cover the face of the earth. Verse 6, Come now, therefore, I pray thee, curse me this people, for they are too mighty for me. Evidently, Balaam had a reputation as a pretty good curser, or something like that. And so, to make the story short, not read all chapters involved in this today, we go to verse 12. God said to Balaam, Thou shalt not go with them. Thou shalt not curse the people, for they are blessed. Whatever God blesses, no one can curse. So Balaam told the messengers that news, and Balak revealed that he was very persistent. Verse 15, And Balak sent yet again princes, more and more honorable than they. So the VIPs come to Balaam from the Moabites, and they plead with him again to come curse Israel. Verse 20, God said to Balaam, because Balaam was interested in going, Rise up and go with them, but the word which I shall say unto thee, that shalt thou do. Verse 21, Balaam rose up in the morning, saddled his donkey, and went with the princes of Moab. Then comes the familiar story that shows up in all the children's books, complete with pictures. Balaam and the donkey, you know. The donkey sees the angel of the Lord, and even donkeys know how to respect the angel of the Lord. Balaam is so blind he couldn't see it. And after he'd beat on the donkey because he was apparently obstinate, wouldn't go straight ahead, and after the donkey had crushed his foot against the wall at the gate, Balaam began beating on the donkey. Verse 28, The Lord opened the mouth of the donkey and said unto Balaam, What have I done to you that you should smite me these three times? And Balaam said, Because you've mocked me. I wish I had a sword, I'd kill you. And the donkey said to Balaam, Am not I thine donkey upon which thou hast ridden ever since I was thine unto this day? Have I ever done anything like this to you? And he said, No. Can you imagine a man dialoguing with a donkey without even being surprised? He should have fallen off of the donkey in surprise, but instead he was so uptight that he could go ahead and talk with the donkey as though it was a regular everyday procedure. That shows how angry a man can get, and also how bent he can be on his own ends. He was persistent. He was rebellious. He was going to do his way or not. Then the Lord finally opened the eyes of Balaam. He saw the angel of the Lord, and in spite of that, verse 34, in spite of all the evidence, Balaam says, last line of the verse, If it displease thee, I will get me back home again, if it displease thee. And the angel said, Go ahead and go. But remember, what I tell you is what you'll have to say. So Balaam arrives at Balak's palace, and the next day Balak takes him out to the top of the high place of Baal, overlooking the camp of Israel. Balaam goes through his mumbo-jumbo. He offers up certain ceremonial things there, apparently very much akin to the sacrifices of God's people. And then he begins to talk, trying to curse Israel. You find this in Numbers, the 23rd chapter, Verse 8, how shall I curse whom God hath not cursed? How shall I defy whom the Lord hath not defied? Verse 10, let me die the death of the righteous. Let my last end be like his. And Balak says, I beg your pardon. I brought you out here to curse these people, and you have altogether blessed them. And he reminded Balak, I can only say what God tells me. Balak says, let's try again. We'll go to another spot. He went to the top of Mount Pisgah. There, evidently, they could only see part of the encampment of Israel. And he hoped that Balaam would not be so impressed with their numbers, and perhaps he could curse them by sections. And he goes through his ritual again, and this time he begins his statement in the 23rd chapter, verse 19. God is not a man that he should lie, neither the Son of Man that he should repent. Hath he said, and shall he not do it? Or hath he spoken, and shall he not make it good? Behold, I have received commandment to bless, and he hath blessed, and I cannot reverse it. And then comes a strange statement, verse 21. He, God, hath not beheld iniquity in Jacob, neither hath he seen perverseness in Israel. And right at that moment, down there in the camp of Israel, were at least 24,000 people who were doomed to die in the next few days because of their iniquity and because of their perverseness. Was God blind? Didn't he see these 24,000? Or up to a point, does God in his kindness and his love look on through the imputed and imparted righteousness and consider a body of people as not perverse? Evidently, we've had some evidence of that in our past history. In spite of rebels, in spite of lack of belief, in spite of wandering in the wilderness, what are we told? The church is still the object of God's supreme regard. He doesn't look at the church the way some of it is, but he looks at it through the eyes of mercy, up to a point, up to a point. Don't forget those words in verse 21. Well, Balaam continues with a blessing upon these people, and finally, in verse 25, Balak tells him to stop. Don't curse them at all, nor bless them at all. He says, essentially, it'd be better for you to just stop right there while we're still ahead. Don't say anything more. And Balaam reminds him of the Lord's command, and Balak foolishly says, well, we'll try one more time. They go to the top of Mount Baal Peor. And from the top of Peor, they look down, and they go through their hocus pocus again. And then Balaam opens his mouth, chapter 24, verse 5, and he says, how goodly are thy tents, O Jacob, and thy tabernacles, O Israel. Verse 8, God brought him forth out of Egypt. He shall eat up the nations, his enemies, and shall break their bones and pierce them through with his arrows. Blessed is he that blesseth thee, and cursed is he that curseth thee. Verse 9, and Balak's anger was kindled against Balaam. Do you blame him? And he smote his hands together. And Balak said unto Balaam, I call thee to curse mine enemies, and behold, thou hast altogether blessed them these three times. Therefore now flee thou to thy place. Get out of here. You better get out of my sight. You better get home. And as Balaam is leaving, he shouts another blessing over his shoulder, of all things. Verse 17 is included in those parting words, and is considered one of the most interesting predictions of the coming Messiah in all of Scripture. I shall see him, but not now. I shall behold him, but not nigh. There shall come a star out of Jacob, and a scepter shall rise out of Israel, and shall smite the corners of Moab, and destroy all the children of Seth. Well, of course, Balaam went home licking his wounds because he had lost his own ego, you know. His damage was deep. He had hoped to get honor and riches, and all he got was Balak's displeasure. Balak went home, began to pace in his plush carpets in his palace, and wonder what he's going to do next. You see him tugging on his beard, scratching his head. He's not big enough to fight. His psychological warfare has gone sour. What happens now? Balaam wasn't so dumb. He remembered some of the things concerning why God's people were blessed. And as he was looking at the ceiling one night, he came up with a bright idea. You find the suggestion of his strategy in the book Patriarchs and Prophets. And you see Balaam showing up again at the palace of Balak. He said the reason that these people are blessed is because of their allegiance to the God of heaven and because of their obedience. Now, if you can in some way, by strategy, get them to break their allegiance and their obedience, no one will have to curse them. The curse will be automatic. And Balak says, now you're talking sense. Do you have any ideas? And Balaam said, yes. The women of Moab are known to be among the most beautiful women. And he says, I would suggest that you pick out of the most beautiful women the most beautiful among them. And you send them over to wander near the camp of the people of Israel. And seduce them to the idol worship that you ordinarily carry on at the high places. Balak was really listening now, and they came up with a plan. And what they had been unable to do by cursing, they were able to do by stratagem. And we're told in the book Patriarchs and Prophets that the first people to go to the party that was held on top of Mount Baal Peor were many of the leaders in Israel. 24,000 went and watched the festivities. The party was a tremendous success. You know, we even see a reasonable facsimile of this in our day. America, bicentennial year, established as the land of the free, the home of the brave. America, established upon the four freedoms, including freedom to worship God. Established because Puritans and others came looking for that. Known as a Christian country for centuries. Finally discovers itself going down the tube because Eastern countries that don't reverence and fear God got us involved in scrapping with arms in the Far East, which was a clever maneuver, distracting our attention from the internal job they expected to do right within the precincts of our own country. They said they'd do it. I think that the crossfire in Europe and Asia was only a crying baby to distract us from their real purpose, to infiltrate us. And by immorality, the same as the people of Moab, to break down our interior fabric until they would have us. And they have done a beautiful job, right? To where God's blessing can no longer exist. The country goes into apostasy just like in the days of Israel. It can happen to a country, it can happen to a church. And the curse is ultimately automatic. One of the strange things about this experience is that Moses evidently didn't see. Moses didn't see what's happened to Moses. He's the one that could tell what was going on from the top of Mount Sinai in the plains below. He's the one who knew what was going on when they danced around the golden calf. It was Moses who had access to the Urim and Thummim through Aaron and Eleazar. And he didn't know what was going on until the apostasy became practically national. 24,000, including people and leaders. Evidently, God allows some of his leaders to be blind for a time until the time is ripe. Someone gave me a little formula one time. I've used it many times since. They said, if something goes wrong, don't forget T over O. T over O. I said, what's that? He said, on God's time, in God's time, and on his occasion, he will make things right. T over O. It has no mathematical logic to it, but I mean, you don't divide time by occasion, as far as I know. But in God's time and on his occasion, if you've seen wrong in the church, if you've seen wrong at headquarters, if you've seen wrong among leaders, evidently God knows. And though some will look blind for a while, he takes care of it in his time and on his occasion. Suddenly it became known to Moses, chapter 25. Verse 3, Israel joined himself to Baal-peor. The anger of the Lord was kindled. And the Lord said unto Moses, verse 4, take all the heads of the people and hang them up before the Lord against the sun, that the fierce anger of the Lord may be turned away from Israel. And Moses said unto the judges of Israel, slay ye every one his men that were joined unto Baal-peor. There was a slaughter. There were hangings. 24,000 people lost their lives in the hangings, the slaughter, and in the plague that broke out. And right in the middle of this, of all times, comes one of the most interesting experiences. Rather gory. Verse 6. Starting, one of the princes of Israel, Zimri by name, came back from the party at Baal-peor. And he had a Moabite harlot with him. He went through the camp right in front of Moses and the people who were mourning for the apostasy and took her right into his tent. Now there was a son of Eleazar, Phinehas by name, who couldn't take this. And evidently moved by God, he grabbed his javelin, followed Zimri and Cosby into the tent, and nailed them both into the ground with his javelin. You have to admit, there were interesting things went on in those days. You'd have to also call that rather directive counseling. You know, today, we would be inclined to say, well, poor Zimri, you know, we might go and knock on the tent door and wait for him to answer and say, Zimri, you've got problems, don't you? Yes. Let's talk about it. Let's sit down. Let's have some counseling sessions. Let's use the Rogerian approach. Did your mother take your candy away from you when you were 9 years old? Were you dropped on your head? Let's talk about it for a while. Maybe we can help you. Let's have 6 months of sessions. No, it was the direct approach, javelin through the stomach. And we say, well, would this be the kind of thing that God would do today if it was a theocracy? Evidently. We're very merciful. We're very kind. You know, this thing with Phinehas didn't happen all by accident. It was quite deliberate. There are people today who are trying to have such a God of love that he never hurts anybody. And the earthquake just happened to come at the proper time with Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. Everything just happened naturally. Some people try too hard. God is a God of love. He's also a God of justice. And we better never forget that. People ultimately destroy themselves in the end because of their attitude and their rebellion. It's their choice. Well, let's not say that God has nothing to do with it happening. As a result of Phinehas's act, he was honored with the priesthood in his family forever. Well, finally, the sifting and the shaking and the reorganization of the lines in Israel was finished on the banks of the Jordan. And Eliezer, Phinehas's dad, was asked to number Israel. They counted them up, and to their interest, they discovered that everyone who had left Egypt, who were 20 years old and upward, just as God had predicted years before, everyone was gone, except Caleb and Joshua and Moses. Numbers, the 26th chapter, verses 64 and 65. But among these, there was not a man of them whom Moses and Aaron the priest numbered when they numbered the children of Israel in the wilderness of Sinai. For the Lord had said of them, they shall surely die in the wilderness. And there was not left a man of them save Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, and Joshua, the son of Nun, and Moses. Don't forget, it was the same movement, but a brand new generation. Same movement, new generation. If we are repeating the history of this people, we can expect the same movement that started to enter the promised land, but a different generation. And there would only be two, Caleb and Joshua, when they actually crossed the Jordan, because Moses was yet to go. And we want to talk next about Moses when he says farewell on the banks of the Jordan River. In the meantime, let's go over to the Advent movement today. Do we have any parallels? We've suggested some in our country, maybe even in our church. In the early Advent movement, people made fun. They scoffed. They came out after the great disappointment, and they said, well, you people, we thought that you had your ascension robes ready and you were going to go up, and you're still with us. Isn't that interesting? How come you didn't go up? They laughed, they made fun, they ridiculed, they cursed. But cursing has never hurt anybody. It has only given publicity. Even the blood of the martyrs was the seed of the gospel. Smart people don't curse. They know they only help the cause of the underdog. I noticed a book by Giovanni Papini. You might expect where he's from. And his whole premise in his book was on the devil, and that we are way too hard on the devil. If we'd stop being so hard on the devil, we'd have less people interested in him, because the masses tend to be sympathetic toward the underdog. We should not be so hard on the devil, and he wouldn't get as far, was his premise. Well, perhaps there's some truth to that. Maybe we talk way too much about the devil. The Desire of Ages says that. Cursing has never hurt God's people, never hurt his movement. There have been curses from within and curses from without. I remember as a boy going to Michigan with my father and uncle who were holding meetings. They opened up their meetings in a large hall downtown. Grand Rapids Mission. There was quite a group of people on the front row the first night. Found out later where they were from. Some pastor in a large church in town had gotten threatened by these public meetings coming along, and he had made a statement in his church that if anyone went to those meetings, they'd be disfellowshipped from the church. As a result, there was a large crowd there the first night. Camp meeting in the Northwest several years ago. Some people had gotten uptight about the people with the mimeograph machines and the tape recorders, you know. The ones that grind off the material against the movement. And they got up at camp meeting and said, "This material, have you heard about it? Whatever you do, don't read it. Go home and burn it." And I knew people who went home and pulled it out of their wastebasket and read it because of that. Go along the highway, you see a sign that says, "Don't read the other side of this sign." Everybody turns and reads it. And so the devil knows that. And after he's cursed for a while and tried to downgrade and ridicule, he'll reverse his tactics, and sometimes he reverses them overnight. The first thing with Israel, curse them. The next thing, be friendly. Accept them. Invite them to a party. That works beautifully. Reverse play. Throw them off. And so what did we add? In recent years, we've had much more friendliness, contact with religion at large, different groups. We have the ecumenical movement, let's be friends, let's bury our differences. We're all brothers. Everybody's going to the same place, all roads to the same kingdom. Let's be friends. The enemy reverses his tactics. I'd like to point out that at the very end, before Jesus comes, we have plenty of evidence that there's going to be a heavy inroad of immorality. Just as literally in the days of Israel. I'd also like to point out that the only people who go for it are the ones who are trusting to themselves instead of to the Lord Jesus Christ. Then I'd like to remind you that in Bible prophecy, a woman represents what? A woman represents what? The church. In Revelation, a pure woman symbolizes a pure church, a fallen woman, a corrupt woman, a fallen, corrupt church. So if the Exodus movement is a prediction in prophecy of the Advent people, then in the prophetic sense, you could have the women of Moab symbolizing the heathen or fallen churches. Does the Bible speak of such? Babylon? Fallen churches. Have you heard of spiritualism and the three unclean spirits like frogs? Have you heard of how frogs catch their prey with their tongues? Have you heard of the charismatic? Have you heard of cross-sections of your own people becoming enamored with that? Have you seen fraternization with the women of Moab in the prophetic spiritual sense as well? Watch out for it. We've seen some, we may see a whole lot more before we're finished. Look for the prophetic symbolism and the literal interpretation of what happened to Israel just before they entered the Promised Land. God's purpose is to separate his people from the world. Satan's purpose is to separate God's people from God. The cursing is always automatic when that happens. It never fails. In conclusion, What we really see just on the borders of the Promised Land is a mighty sifting and shaking taking place. It happened in Israel, and it happens today. Some months ago, we talked here for a few Sabbaths about the shaking time. And I'd like to give you just the review of the points of that series. Just before Jesus comes, there is going to be a mighty sifting and shaking that begins with great emphasis upon the theme of righteousness by faith. The first part is a rise in that message and that experience. The next thing that happens is that this shakes people up. It shakes people up because there's a large cross-section of Christians, including our own church, who have chosen to rely upon themselves instead of upon God completely. This is described in the book Desire of Ages, page 280. This will prove the ruin of many souls in our day. Rather than give up some cherished idea or discard some idol of opinion, many refuse the truth which comes down from the Father of Light. They trust in themselves and depend upon their own wisdom and do not realize their spiritual poverty. They insist on being saved in some way by which they may perform some important work. When they see that there is no way of weaving self into the work, they reject the salvation provided. There are people who will sing and shout and pray, apparently, when there's a religion that gives them partially something to do to earn their way. But when they see that there's no way of weaving self into the plan of salvation, that God has to do it all, they will become so threatened by this that they will reject the salvation, the total picture. And so the emphasis upon righteousness by faith in Christ alone, whether it's justification or sanctification or glorification, leads people to get shaken up. As a result of this, people divide into two groups. Those who are on God's side and those who aren't. Those who are on God's side begin to have tremendous power called the latter rain and the swelling of this message into what's called a loud cry. And there's tremendous success as people who have never heard what they have to say listen and accept. As a result of this, there comes next a sifting. The sifting is when people get nervous and begin persecuting those who are having success with the truth of God. But this persecution comes down upon the heads not only of the faithful, but of those who are not on God's side, but are still in the pew. As a result of this, those who are still in the pew, but not on God's side, leave. They leave so fast you cannot see them for dust. And the same kind of changing lines that took place on the banks of the Jordan take place among God's people just before Jesus comes. A shaking and a sifting. And then the final events that click ever so fast take place. Jesus is seen coming in the clouds of heaven. Needless to say, in quoting from the book, volume 5, page 79, in the mighty sifting soon to take place, we shall be better able to measure the strength of Israel today. The signs reveal that the time is near when the Lord will thoroughly purge His floor. In this time, the gold will be separated from the dross in the church. True godliness will be clearly distinguished from the appearance and tinsel of it. Many a star that we have admired for its brilliancy will then go out in darkness. Chaff like a cloud will be borne away on the wind, even from places where we see only floors of rich wheat. All who assume the ornaments of the sanctuary, but are not clothed with Christ's righteousness, will appear in the shame of their own nakedness. Then will appear the church of Christ, fair as the moon, clear as the sun, and terrible as an army with banners. It happened in Israel, and it will happen today. As the storm approaches, a large class who have professed faith in the third angel's message, but have not been sanctified by the truth, abandon their position and join the ranks of the opposition. By uniting with the world and partaking of its spirit, they have come to view matters in nearly the same light, and when the test is brought, they are prepared to choose the easy, popular side. I don't want to appear in the shame of my own nakedness. Do you?
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. This recording has been digitally reprocessed from the original audio cassette or reel-to-reel in order to make this CD available. The audio quality was improved as much as possible. International copyright, American Christian Ministries. All rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.AmericanChristianMinistry.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There's no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with the speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He is coming soon.